Serial started to run, I had a number of sections already completed. As the months went by, however, I had fewer and fewer pages in hand, and towards the end I was only 3 episodes ahead of publication. This was very different, then, from merely taking an existing manuscript and chopping it up into sections. The book was written while it was being published. An obvious consequence of this was that I could not go back and make changes. It was too late to do that. What I've tried to do in 44 Scotland Street is to say something about life in Edinburgh, which will strike readers as being recognisably about this extraordinary city, and yet at the same time be a bit of light-hearted fiction. I think that one can write about amusing subjects and still remain within the realm of serious fiction. It is in observing the minor ways of people that one can still see very clearly the moral dilemmas of our time. One task of fiction is to remind us of the virtues, of love and forgiveness, for example, and these can be portrayed just as well in an ongoing story of everyday life as they can on a more ambitious and more leisurely canvas. I enjoyed creating these characters, all of whom reflect human types I have encountered and known while living in Edinburgh. It is only one slice of life in this town, but it is a slice which can be entertaining. Some of the people in this book are real, and appear under their own names. My fellow writer, Ian Rankin, for example, appears as himself. He said to me, though, that I had painted him as being far too well behaved, and that he would never have acted so well in real life. I replied to him that his self-effacing comment only proved my original proposition. Then there are some who appear as themselves but have no speaking part. That great and good man Tam Dyel does that. We see him, but we do not hear what he says. We also see mention of another 2 admirable and much-liked public figures, Malcolm Rifkind and Lord James Douglas Hamilton, who flit across the page but who, like Mr. Dyel, remain silent. Perhaps all 3 of them could be given a speaking part in a future volume, if they agree, of course. I enjoyed writing this so much that I could not bear to say goodbye to the characters, so that most generous paper, The Scotsman, agreed to a 2nd volume, which is still going strong, day after day, even as I write this introduction to Volume 1. In the somewhat demanding task of writing both of these volumes, I have been sustained by the readers of the paper, who urged me on and provided me with a wealth of suggestions and comments. I feel immensely privileged to have been able to sustain a long fictional conversation with these readers. Alexander McCall Smith, January 2005. Number 1. Stuff Happens. Pat stood before the door at the bottom of the stair, reading the names underneath the buttons. Syme, MacDonald, Pollock, and then the name she was looking for. Anderson. That would be Bruce Anderson, the surveyor, the person to whom she'd spoken on the telephone. He was the one who collected the rent, he said, and paid the bills. He was the one who'd said that she could come and take a look at the place and see whether she wanted to live there. "And we'll take a look at you," he had added, "if you don't mind." So now she thought she would be under inspection, assessed for suitability for a shared flat, weighed up to see whether she was likely to play music too loudly or have friends who would damage the furniture, or, she supposed, whether she would jar on anybody's nerves. She pressed the bell and waited. After a few moments something buzzed, and she pushed open the large black door with its numerals 44, its lion's head knocker, and its tarnished brass plate above the handle. The door was somewhat shabby, needing a coat of paint to cover the places where the paintwork had been scratched or chipped away. Well, this was Scotland Street, not Murray Place or Doon Terrace, not even Drummond Place, the handsome square from which Scotland Street descended in a steep slope. This street was on the edge of the bohemian part of the Edinburgh New Town, the part where lawyers and accountants were outnumbered, just, by others. She climbed up 4 flights of stairs to reach the top landing. 2 flats led off this, one with a dark green door and no nameplate in sight, and another painted blue with a piece of paper on which 3 names had been written in large lettering. As she stepped onto the landing, the blue door was opened, and she found herself face to face with a tall young man, probably 3 or 4 years older than herself, his dark hair en brosse, and wearing a rugby jersey. "Triple Crown," she read, "next year," and after that, in parenthesis, the word, "maybe." "I'm Bruce," he said, "and I take it you're Pat." He smiled at her and gestured for her to come into the flat. "I like the street," she said. "I like this part of town." He nodded. "So do I. I lived up in Marchmont until a year ago, and now I'm over here. It's central. It's quiet. Marchmont got a bit too studenty." She followed him into a living room, a large room with a black marble fireplace on one side and a rickety bookcase against the facing wall. "This is the sitting room," he said. "It's nothing great, but it gets the sun." She glanced at the sofa, which was covered with a faded chintzy material, stained in 1 or 2 places with spills of tea or coffee. It was typical of the sofas which one found in shared flats as a student. Sofas that had been battered and humiliated, slept on by drunken and sober friends alike, and which would, on cleaning, disgorge copious sums in change and ballpoint pens and other bits and pieces dropped from generations of pockets. She looked at Bruce. He was good-looking in a way which one might describe as, well, how might one describe it? Fresh-faced? Open? Of course, the rugby shirt gave it away. He was the sort that one saw by the hundred, by the thousand, streaming out of Murrayfield after a rugby international. Wholesome was the word which her mother would have used, and which Pat would have derided. But it was a useful word when it came to describe Bruce. Wholesome. Bruce was returning her gaze. 20, he thought. Quite expensively dressed. Tanned in a way which suggested outside pursuits. Average height. Attractive enough in a rather willowy way. Not my type. This last conclusion with a slight tinge of regret. "What do you do?" he asked. Occasions like this, he thought, were times for bluntness. One might as well find out as much as one could before deciding to take her. And it was he who would have to make the decision because Ian and Sarah were off travelling for a few months, and they were relying on him to find someone. Pat looked up at the cornice. "I'm on a gap year," she said, and added, because truth required it after all, "It's my second gap year, actually." Bruce stared at her, and then burst out laughing. "Your second gap year?" Pat nodded. She felt miserable. Everybody said that. Everybody said that because they had no idea of what had happened. "My first one was a disaster," she said, "so I started again." Bruce picked up a matchbox and rattled it absent-mindedly. "What went wrong?" he asked. "Do you mind if I don't tell you? Or just not yet?" He shrugged. "Stuff happens," he said. "It really does." After her meeting with Bruce, Pat returned to her parents' house on the south side of Edinburgh. She found her father in his study, a disorganized room stacked with back copies of the Journal of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. She told him of the meeting with Bruce. "It didn't last long," she said. "I'd expected a whole lot of them, but there was only him. The others were away somewhere or other." Her father raised an eyebrow. In his day, young people had shared flats with others of the same sex. There were some mixed flats, of course, but these were regarded as being a bit, how should one put it, adventurous. He'd shared a flat in Argyle Place.